Tim Tebow striding to the plate confidently. First at bat of his debut. First pitch of his debut. Tebow driving one to left center and
whoa!
How about that, Paul Feinbaum?
I am cheering for my good friend and partner. I mean, listen, Tim is committed. That's typical Tim Tebow. Why should anyone be surprised that he hits a home run in the first at bat?
Miguel drives one deep to the right center field gap. On the run, Almonte's by him all the way to the scoreboard in right center. Kinzer and Maven in. Cabrera to second. 2-run double. Three batters in. 2-0 Tigers. Fly ball, center field, deep. Going back, Naquin still going. Looking up. It's gone! A home run! Miguel Cabrera straightaway center. 3-run shot. Fly ball, left field, deep down the left field line. Goodbye. Justin Upton with a towering blast. Indians manager Terry Francona resting almost all of his regulars in this game. Only Santana and Naquin were among the regulars in the lineup. 7 reserves. And Justin Verlander took full advantage. He dominated through 7 2/3 innings. 1 walk, 12 strikeouts for Justin as he just absolutely cruised through his 7 2/3 innings. Lowered his ERA to 3.10, picked up win number 16.
This is what you always want, and this is what they want. Rookie or not, you want to pitch in these big situations and big games. I think we've got a good mix right now of guys that have been through the grind and understand what the ebbs and flows are like. And granted, this has been a little bit different than a normal season, but you still can understand that we have a good team. And just because we've lost a few in a row, we can turn it around just as quickly, and we've done that many times.
Really? Everyone kind of contributed. Every faction of the team contributed. Justin was outstanding. You know, Tito was probably doing some stuff with his pitching staff. He certainly has the luxury of being able to line up the guys he wants and needs going into the postseason. It helps a lot. You know, when you have one of the best pitchers in the game on the mound and you spot him a 5-run lead early, you certainly feel good about where you are. You're never comfortable, but you feel good about where you are.
Well, not my best case, but I mean, it's a heck of a lot better than it could have been. I mean, I think we were hopeful that he'd be okay, but, you know, when a guy's out there competing, you don't know how much they're really hurting, but this will give them a chance to hopefully have a bullpen session or two. Hopefully, maybe it'll even help them. But I think it's certainly not bad news.
It helped DeShone Kizer, who was responsible for 6 touchdowns. Kizer, quarterback draw. Points to 10. Kizer, good move at the 5. Kizer to the end zone.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Alrighty then. Wow, we have a lot of really interesting stories to talk about today as we begin right here on the Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket, where we are Toledo's sports leader. Hope you're having a great Wednesday afternoon. I got to tell you, the Corey Kluber story is very interesting, of course, for all of the obvious reasons. With respect to the playoffs coming up, the Indians already being down 2 starters, the Tigers rolling the Indians AAA club essentially last night 12-0 as they continue to try to find a spot in the baseball wild card game. All of that is very, very interesting. Basketball, of course, is back because the media days have happened, and now practices are getting started, so we're going to talk about that today. But how can we start anywhere other than with Tim Tebow starting his baseball career with a bang, and I do mean a bang. Tebow goes yard in his first, not only his first at bat, his first pitch that he ever saw as a professional paid baseball player.
First at bat of his debut, first pitch of his debut, Tebow driving one to left center and
whoa!
How about that, Paul Feinbaum?
I am cheering for my good friend and partner. I mean, listen, Tim is committed. That's typical Tim Tebow. Why should anyone be surprised that he hits a home run in the first at bat?
Nobody should be surprised. Everybody should, however, be extraordinarily excited and enthusiastic. I love every single second of this. Tim Tebow down in Port St. Lucie, Florida, the Mets spring training camp. which is where their instructional league is. Their instructional, what do you call it? Is it an instructional league?
No, it's an instructional league because it's not the fall leagues yet, and that's out in Arizona anyway. Yes.
But they do play other teams. It's not just all intra-squads.
Exactly.
That's the reason I said, is it a league, or how do they actually set this up? But his very first professional at-bat, the very first professional pitch he sees, he takes the opposite way. He, of course, is a huge, powerful left-handed hitter, goes left center, goes over left center. So oppo for Tim Tebow, and what an unbelievable story. And all of the haters are beside themselves all over Twitter, Jim Cushman.
That part doesn't surprise me. And, you know, you've heard me in the past, Bob. From a on-the-field football standpoint, I was never a big fan of his. But as I've also said in this whole scenario with him trying out and then eventually being signed by the Mets, stick him in the minors. If he pans out, we'll see him in a couple years. No big deal. Let him try. I have nothing whatsoever. Nothing.
A lot of people did. A lot of people felt like, you know, even giving him a shot at an instructional league or a single A club or double A club the way Michael Jordan got it, all of those kinds of things. They said that it's taking a spot away from some other young 20-something prospect.
Did they say that about Jordan in 94?
Yeah, they did, actually. A lot of people did. A lot of people felt like it was, especially at double A. He didn't start out at single A or instructional league. They sent him right to double A Birmingham with the Barons, which, of course, is, you know, it's not as low as the lowest rung on the minor league ladder. You're two steps away from the major leagues at that level. And they did say that about Michael Jordan. But not too many people really. I think people in Jordan's case, and Jim, we've talked about this a little bit before. In Jordan's case, I think people were just still so confused and so shocked. Why is the three-time defending champion walking away from the game that he dominates? Why is the greatest player the world has ever seen at this sport leaving the sport in his prime to go play baseball? People were shocked more than they were angry, I think, although people did question whether or not it was right for the White Sox to take a spot, which is limited, on the AA roster and give it to a guy who had, you know, it's similar to Tebow in that he had never played since high school, but Tim Tebow was really, really good in high school. Michael Jordan was not. And so there was, a bit of a shell-shocked, I think, attitude or atmosphere, or whatever you want to call it, around the people who were watching Michael Jordan at that time. With Tebow, it's not shock, it's anger, because he's not a guy walking away from his sport that he dominated to just go try a new challenge. He failed at his first sport by virtually all measures, even though he was 7-4 as a starter, and we know he won a playoff game with the Broncos, et cetera, et cetera. But by and large, I mean, look at some of the names that are playing quarterback in the National Football League right now. And he's not one of them.
Yep.
He can't beat out, you know, even some of the real bottom rung guys. And so he failed at his first, you know.
As far as I know, the Browns never tried to even reach out to him in all those years.
They didn't.
That says it all in some ways right there, doesn't it?
And how funny would it be if eventually, instead of that, he ends up playing with the Indians? Huh? No, but it's anger because he failed at his first sport. For some people, it is anyway. And now he's like, okay, well then I'm going to go try a different sport. As if, like, dude, this isn't that easy. You have no business trying to play a professional sport. You know, when there are other guys where this is their life, and you're just doing this on a whim. This is their life. They've been working on this since they were teenagers. They're at single A trying to climb the ladder to high A ball, trying to climb the ladder to double A ball, and all the way down the line. And they feel like he's being given a gift here because of his notoriety and his fame, and that it's just nothing but a
show. You know
what?
I disagree with that mindset.
It's a dog and pony marketing show.
And you know why I actually disagree with that mindset profusely right now as I'm thinking about it? Because this isn't 20 years ago. How many times have we gone over that, you know, a guy that has a lot of athleticism, back in the day, they would have and gone at least minimum through all of high school playing all the various different sports, and maybe even into college if they were talented enough. But nowadays, you know, once you get into high school, and again, this will sound familiar, right? It's you got to choose, pick one of them and focus just on that. It's not like it used to be. So, okay, he was a good baseball player, you know, in high school. He wanted to concentrate on football. And in the world we live in now, that meant giving everything else up in a way that it wouldn't have been 25 years ago.
Yeah, I think there is some truth to that. And I've brought up the example of other guys who have done this, you know, which, you know, and it was in the 80s, obviously, when both Bo Jackson and Deion Sanders
right.
played two professional sports. But again, nobody really had a problem with them because they were good at both of them. You know, Bo Jackson was an all-star and a pro bowler. Deion Sanders was a pro bowler, and
yeah.
He was never an all-star with the Reds in his time in baseball, but,
sure.
you know, he stuck. With the big league club, and he made some plays. He scored some runs. He got some hits, and he was able to succeed. But nobody had a problem with it. And I've pointed this out many times before. There have been a lot of guys who failed at one or the other who tried the other. Drew Henson, the former Wolverine we talked about, left the Wolverines and went to do baseball. Said, I've got choices here. I can go to the NFL draft. I'm a highly touted prospect. Or I can go play baseball with the Yankees, and they had already offered him a contract. And so he took baseball. It didn't work. He couldn't hit his weight. And so he said, okay, I'm coming back to play football.
Yeah.
And he got a chance with the Cowboys and a couple of other clubs.
How about this for a way back machine kind of a reference, especially for your Cleveland fans? We all remember the story of how Kenny Lofton was on a Final Four team.
That's right.
Arguably, he could have tried basketball if he wanted to, but he was a little bit better at baseball. And we know how that story turned out.
Charlie Ward. There's another
yes.
one. Charlie Ward, who was the
Heisman Trophy winner.
At Florida State. A Heisman Trophy winner, but undersized and probably wasn't going to make it in the NFL. So even though that was clearly his best sport, he was also talented enough at basketball
yep.
that he ended up having a little modest career in the NBA as a point guard. I think he was with the Knicks, and they don't remember where else he bounced
to. It was a pedestrian career, but he made it.
Yeah, exactly. But the point is nobody had a problem saying, okay, one sport, your primary sport didn't work out for you or wasn't going to work out for you. If you have an opportunity to go and pursue your secondary sport, what is wrong with that? And here's the conclusion I've come to here. Tim Tebow, and I've talked about this before, and if it ruffles a few feathers, well, then you know what? I don't care. I just don't. I'm not trying to be, you know, argumentative or difficult here. But I think what's going on here is that Tim Tebow is a victim of his own skin color and his own faith. He is a white Christian athlete, outspoken about being a Christian. You know, brings God and weaves God into a lot of his commentary, a lot of his interviews. Certainly is not shy about telling people when he is doing missionary work. Just not shy about telling people when he's doing ministry work to drug addicts in prisons all around Florida, trying to bring them over to a new way of life. And to be honest with you, he's, in some people's minds, he's too good to be true. And because he's too good to be true, too devout, too moralistic, too polite, to everything that he must not be. That there's something to him that people don't know, and that they don't like being compared to him. They don't like looking at themselves and saying, "I'm not as good or as devout or as loyal or as moral or whatever you want to call it as Tim Tebow." And they don't like having their own shortcomings revealed to them when they look at somebody who's doing everything in a very, very unique way, a way that most other people can't do. He doesn't swear. He doesn't drink. He doesn't smoke. He doesn't have premarital sex, to the best of our knowledge. That was a big story about him, too, even in college. You know, good-looking kid, big muscular guy, probably has girls all over the place who would want to be with him, and he doesn't do it. And again, he's constantly quoting scripture and God and so on. And I think there's just a whole lot of people. And I'm one of them. I'm one of them who don't measure up to some of the things that he does and the way he lives his life. And some of those people, and I am not one of these, really resent him for it. And so they don't want to see him succeed. They want him to fade away. Good, they thought. His football career didn't work out. The Broncos ended up cutting him. He had a shot with the Eagles. They let him go. He shot with the Patriots. Belichick didn't want him. Shot with the Jets. Jets didn't keep him. All right, he failed good. Now we're finally done with this really holier-than-thou guy living his life way better than we live ours and reminding us all about it every time we see him. That is what he is. And I'll tell you something else. It's not just the way he lives his life. It's the fact that he lives his life as a Christian. Because I promise you that if his faith was another faith, if his faith was Islam, or if his faith was Judaism, or if his faith was, I don't know, Hindu or Buddhism for that matter, nobody would have a problem with their devoutness. Nobody would have a problem with it. They would say, what an honorable thing. But Christians are easy to pick on. And again, if this ruffles some feathers, you know what? Deal with it. deal with it, change the channel, I don't care. I'm just going to be honest with you here. He's a white Christian, and that makes him privileged in today's SJW social justice warrior society, in which everybody's got a cause because everybody other than white male straight Christians is put down upon and oppressed. Just ask Colin Kaepernick and Megan Rapinoe and everybody else who's taking part in this ridiculous protest movement. Anybody who is straight, white, male, and Christian has all of the check marks in the privilege column. And if he's privileged like that, well, then, by God, we can't wish good things for him. He's already got the world by the you-know-whats. Why does he have to do this, too? Why does he have to be, great at baseball? And we don't know if he will be or not, but he hit a home run in his first pitch. He's already got I don't even know what his contract would be for the SEC Network. I almost said a multi-million-dollar contract, but I doubt that. But he's getting paid good money from the SEC Network, in addition to the money he made playing football before he flamed out of the National Football League. Now he can't be good at something else. There's just so much resentment for him, Jim, that would not be there if his skin was a different color, if his God was a different God, or if he carried and lived his life a little bit differently than he does.
And this is why, for me, Bob, I've always tried my best to on the subject of Tim Tebow be sports objective only. As I've said to you, I wasn't really a fan of him when he was playing football, just because I thought he was mediocre at best and getting way too much attention for it. Now, whether some of that attention was because of some of the things you pointed out, that's a different story. But to a small degree, he got a lot of attention as a quarterback, and he wasn't that good.
Yeah, but Jim, he got a lot of attention as a quarterback because he was a Heisman Trophy winner,
right,
and a two-time national champion.
Sure.
And one of the greatest college players in the history of college football. Nobody will dispute that, no matter how his NFL career turned out. We, of course, have seen the NFL landscape littered. The roadside is littered with superstars in college who didn't make great pro,
sure,
pro players, but it doesn't undo what they did at the college level. That's why he got the attention that he got, and he certainly deserved it.
And I agree. He did what he did in college. But as his brief NFL career went on, it was clear he would be mediocre at best. That being said, it's why, from an objective sports position, I, too, am all in favor of what he's doing right now with the Mets organization. Let him have his chance. If he flames out in the minors, you'll never see him at Citi Field or whatever the heck they call the stadium that they now have for the Mets. And if he does, hey, outstanding. What a fun story that would be. That's how I'm trying to handle this.
Well, I tweeted three words when I first saw this, and I retweeted the home run on the first pitch he saw in his first instructional game as a paid professional player. And those three words were in all capital letters, followed by about seven or eight exclamation points. I love it. I love it. I love it. And you want to know why? Because haters going to hate. Haters going to hate.
Yep.
And they can just KMA, as far as I'm concerned. If he had a fanned and taken the collar in his first game and struck out four times swinging, they would have all laughed their heads silly because of this too good to be true golden boy, blah, 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 white privileged Christian dude who didn't deserve a shot at the minor leagues, even the minor leagues at single A. I mean, Jim, I'm looking at the video again. The stands are like little league stands. There's
oh,
like,
yeah,
I don't know, five-step aluminum bleachers there. I mean, I doubt very seriously that that's even the seating that they have for spring training games when the Mets are actually there, every March.
Or the Florida State League team that I'm sure plays there because there's a single A team that usually uses all those same parks in the summer.
Okay. Well, because right now there's several videos of this. Some of them are just uploaded, cell phone cameras, people taking videos.
Because this was not televised or anything.
Exactly. Not televised. Correct. But so there are several different vantage points, and the one I'm looking at now is from almost directly behind home plate, a little bit off to the right, kind of right behind the left-hander's batter's box. And there's the sound. By the way, how did that sound?
It sounded solid to me. If I'm not mistaken, he went kind of opposite field, too.
He did go opposite field. He went to left center.
Yeah,
and
that's what I thought.
According to people who know this sort of thing, and we talk to them in spring a lot. We talk about how the ball sounds coming off
sure.
the bat of certain people. And they talk about guys like where, when Miguel Cabrera, for example, is taking BP, it because of the sound of the ball off the bat. Now,
yep.
You might think, well, it's all hickory. I mean, right? I mean, come on. How many different ways? If you get a hold of one, it's all going to sound the same.
No, listen to tapes. Plenty of them, people. You can find them. They sound different, it seems, coming off different guys' bats. It's exactly. Just weird like that, but it's true.
There are some guys who square them up so solidly and who put so much into that swing that the ball sounds differently coming off of their bats. Well, I'm just reading Twitter, so take it for what it's worth. But this is what people are saying, that is one of those sounds. Listen to this again from the cell phone camera or video of somebody, like I said, behind him, probably
20 feet maybe.
Backstop. Well, you know, what's the backstop? 20, 25
feet. Yeah, 20, 25 feet away.
Behind the plate.
Right.
And like I said, a little bit behind the left-hander's batter's box, which, of course, he is standing in. But listen to the ball off the bat again. I mean, that thing cracks.
That's solid.
It sounds like a cork popping on a champagne bottle, for crying out loud. Holy cow. That's why I keep hearing it. It's just a shot. Anyway, the reason I bring all that up is as I watch it, I won't let you hear the screaming. The person taking the video pans around to the other stands there, like to their friends or something, and it looks like it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, like 5 sets of bleachers.
Yeah.
He's playing in front of less than 100 people, probably. It'd be my guess, anyway. And for him to go out there in those circumstances, again, taking nothing from anybody, there is nobody. I mean, I'll say this again. There's not a roster limit to how many guys you can bring to your instructional league. If there is some 18-year-old who really, really, really wanted the opportunity that Tim Tebow got, guess what? They'd have found him by now. That's the way baseball works. They scout and they send people to independent league games. I mean, who was it who just came up from the Skeeters a couple of years ago? Who was the pitcher?
Oh, geez. I should know this one.
Like the Midland Texas.
I know
Skeeters.
Where you're going with this, but I can't remember the name.
I can't either, but you understand my point. They'll scour all of the independent leagues, the minor leagues, and in Tim Tebow's case, hey, I'm going to hold a workout here. If anybody wants to come and show up, watch me do this. If they think you've got an ounce of talent, they will find you, and they will send you to the instructional league. Tim Tebow didn't take anybody's job away from them in this little teeny tiny band, set of stands here in front of this set of stands here with a few people watching, and he drove one out of here like he'd been doing this his entire life, and he didn't take the job away from anybody else. The haters are always going to hate.
Yep.
And all of the people standing there right now are in, and I'm looking at the still shot now of the home run, or actually of the stands. If he'd have struck out 4 times swinging, like I said, they all would have had it on video and they all would have uploaded this to Twitter and everybody would have just bombarded him with hate and just how, what a joke he is. You know, good at football, you know, better at hitting than you were at passing and all of this stuff. And see, this is a joke. The Mets just did this to sell tickets, to sell jerseys, to make a few bucks off his name, blah, blah. The haters would have been all over it. So for me, I love it, every second of it, and I hope he continues to play extraordinarily well. I hope this is something that brings him, gets him an invite, a non-roster invite maybe, to the big league club camp in March with the New York Mets.
And even if he doesn't get that invite, he'll be in single A or even double A next year.
Yeah,
no big whoop.
Well, that's what I mean. When I say a non-roster invite, I don't mean that he's going to make the big league
club. He won't be on a 40-man roster. He won't be on the Mets 40-man roster. Pretty confident in saying right now.
Bring him there for a couple of weeks of camp before you then reassign him to the minor league camp, which of course would be appropriate, and then let's see what he does.
Yes.
I hope to God that happens because I just want to stick it in the faces of all of the haters out there who are just, you know, I'm going to go here again, even though I don't want to get into this too much, but sometimes you have to get into this sort of thing. You know, again, Colin Kaepernick's knee makes him a hero to so many people in this country, which is sickening to me, disrespecting the United States in the way that he is, the Constitution, the flag, the anthem, and everything they represent. He's a hero. Tim Tebow gets on the same knee as Colin Kaepernick, but bows his head and makes a sign of the cross, and people want it stopped. Yours is great, Colin. Awesome. Love it. Way to stand up for what you believe in. Or actually, way to kneel down for what you believe in. Hey, Tim, we don't need that in public. Stop praying on public property. This is a violation of the separation of church and state. Tim Tebow is hated for getting on one knee. Colin Kaepernick is praised for it. So to me, Colin Kaepernick and those who support it can KMA Tim Tebow. God bless you, brother. Keep on fighting the good fight.
And one last thing real quick, Bob, too. The one argument, if someone's trying to come at that, well, you know, he shouldn't be even doing this. He's taking the one where he's taking something away from one of those 18-year-olds. You know, that's called misplacing. Okay, you're not supposed to be. You don't need to be mad at Tebow for that one. If you want to be mad at somebody on that level, be mad at the Mets. They're the ones who signed him. If none of the teams thought he was good enough to take a flyer on, he wouldn't have gotten an offer. It's that simple, guys. Come on.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And like I said, if you can play even a little bit, they will find you. If they feel like they can
you
know, turn you into something, they'll find you. They'll find you in the deepest cornfields, in the most remote part of Buford, Iowa. And I don't even know if there's a Buford, Iowa. I'm just trying to think of a name and a place where there's cornfields. But they'll find you wherever it is that you might be if you can play this game. So they found Tim Tebow a little bit more easily because he's a big star, big name anyway. He's a celebrity. And he said, hey, I'm going to hold a workout here. I've been training for about 9 months. Come and see what I've got if you'd like. And what, 28 teams were represented?
Yeah, all but two of them were there.
Were not represented there. And one of them considered it and was thinking about signing him, the Braves. The other one, the Mets, did it. And you know what? God bless them. I hope it works out. Speaking of God blessing, let's talk a little bit about Notre Dame football coming up here. Why? Because the Notre Dame Fighting Irish, well, they're not exactly doing touchdown Jesus proud right about now. They're 1-3. And coming up in just a few minutes, we are going to talk with Brendan Riley of 18stripes.com, which, of course, is a Notre Dame football fan site. And we'll talk to him about the fall of the mighty. They were expected to potentially be a playoff team this year, but a 1-3 start has that, of course, those dreams just up in smoke. By the way, speaking of college football, don't forget to stop by the Buckeye Store and More, the College and Pro Superstore, because 10% store-wide savings are in effect for all, and I do literally mean all, of the items on sale at the Buckeye Store and More. Store-wide 10% on hundreds of new Nike products in stock, whether you want to wear them or decorate your home or your office or your cubicle or your car or your man cave with them. Anything you can find in scarlet and gray, it's on sale. But it doesn't have to be scarlet and gray. If you are a fan of the Maize and Blue or those Fighting Irish, the Spartans, the Rockets, the Falcons, the Tigers, everything is 10% off inside the fan zones at the Buckeye Store and More. Find them in Sylvania at 5700 Monroe, that Starlight Plaza. It's right in between Ralphie's and Dave's and in front of Prometica. Big Brutus is waving you in from the roof at the Buckeye Store and More, the College and Pro Superstore.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Outstanding indeed. We need to hear that sound again, don't we, Jim? I like the cheer by whoever it is there right after he... right after he gets that wood on that ball like that, somebody going, hey! It's like, crack, hey, crack, hey. Tim Tebow going yard with his first ever pitch faced in professional baseball. Instructional League, I don't care. It was still an amazing thing to see. Congratulations to him. All right, what is a little bit less amazing, if you're a Fighting Irish fan right now, I know this is going to be a little bit painful to talk about and to acknowledge and to examine, but it has been less than an amazing start for the Notre Dame Fighting Irish, expected to potentially contend for a playoff spot for the first time since the CFP was born. This season, they start out 1-3, and all hell is breaking loose in South Bend. Joining us now to break it down is Brendan Riley, who covers the Fighting Irish for 18stripes.com. Hey, Brendan, how are you, sir?
Hey, Bob, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for taking the time. We certainly appreciate it. Hey, Brian Kelly said everybody, after the most recent loss, everybody's job is up for grabs. Nobody is safe. Is that just coach talk, or is he literally having open tryouts at 22 different positions on offense and defense all week?
I think to some degree it's coaching for sure. You know, he was pretty upset with the effort level and the consistency of effort on Saturday against Duke. And certain key positions, guys need to certainly wake up. There are some other positions where I think he has been pushing guys for a while, and now those positions are going to be open.
Yeah, you know, if you hear Duke beats Notre Dame, you're saying, all right, Coach K, boy, had his boys ready to go again. I mean, that's not that uncommon. That's just the way that it is. And Notre Dame's a great program, but my goodness, that's Duke. No shame in that. But when you find out, no, he's on the football field, there is shame in that. Right. We are talking about Duke. Notre Dame doesn't lose to Duke. How is the atmosphere? What is the mood like among Irish fans right now that you associate with?
I'd say there's pretty much people have moved on from the season. Not that nobody's going to pay attention, but, you know, at 1-3, it's kind of hard to picture a great season coming out of this. You know, even if we win out, you know, it'd be great, obviously, but, you know, you're not going to get that playoff berth that you had originally. I think there's a lot of feeling right now that if we finish 500, that's a little bit of a moral victory. So that's, again, quite a step down. So just overall is, I don't know about panic alarms. I mean, pretty close. People certainly are hovering over the panic button, but, you know, I don't think it's quite that bad, but definitely people are pretty much ready to move on, from this horrific start.
That is a really amazing statement to make. Brendan Riley, who joins us from 18stripes.com, because I feel it and certainly understand it, because this is the nature of college football. If you lose a couple, you are out of the playoff run. Now, the only thing, well, I guess that's my question for you. What is the only thing to stop the players from feeling the same way? They know the fans have given up on them. They know the campus is in a just a hugely, you know, depressing mood right now, or there's an atmosphere of failure and letting everybody down. You know, when you know you don't, and you don't, you're not in a conference, you're Notre Dame. You can't win a conference title. What are you playing for now? How does Brian Kelly get these guys, you know, from starters to backups and everywhere in between, motivated for a season that everybody has given up on and that for all intents and purposes is over because of the lack of a playoff opportunity?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think he's that's the biggest challenge facing him right now. I think there was definitely some, not from any inside information, but just from watching the on-field product on Saturday, I think there was definitely some morale issue with the team, you know, where they kind of sense things circling the drain, and he needs to obviously find a way to stop that. There are a lot of young guys that'll be back next year, so maybe one way to get them focused, to say, hey, you know, we can still build this year, build your experience, build your abilities for next year. There are a couple of guys that are, you know, going to be gone after this year and maybe have some pro aspirations but need to show out this year to actually get there. So, you know, that's maybe another carrot for them. But, it's definitely – it's hard to see one single cohesive thing for everybody to work for right now. So Brian Kelly's going to have to find the right buttons to push for individuals, you know, several times over, which makes it very tricky.
Yeah, no question about that. We're talking to Brendan Riley, who writes for 18stripes.com, a Notre Dame sports site. Jim Cushlin is here as well with us. Cush, go ahead.
And I'm trying to look and figure out exactly what it is, Brendan, that is causing this 1-3 start, specifically in the loss to up two touchdowns early. From everything I've seen, the former Toledo Central Catholic quarterback, DeShone Kizer, who incidentally for everybody has been shooting up the various mock drafts. Bob, I actually saw him once. One mock draft actually had him going 1 to the Browns. I'll believe that when I see it. So it's not really Kizer. What is it that's causing this right now?
Well, it's definitely defense. I mean, you know, I think the consensus among the fans is that if we could have even put an average defense on the field, we'd be 4-0 right now. You know, you look at, we have one score losses in all three games. And, you know, certainly Michigan State's a great team, and maybe there was something where, you know, they went into a shell once they got up big, and maybe we wouldn't have been within one score or whatever. That's fine. But Duke and Texas, those games were definitely winnable. You know, the offense scored 37 in regulation against Texas. They scored 35 against Duke. You can't lose those games. You know, the offense is going out feeling like they have to score on every drive because the defense can't get a stop, you know. And the defense was a disaster, quite frankly. I mean, Brian Van Gorder, the defensive coordinator who was just fired, I think he's a good guy. You know, I think he cares about the school, and his heart was in the right place, but it just wasn't working for him. And, you know, you had a lot of confusion among our players. You know, defense, you wanted to create confusion on the offense, right? It shouldn't create confusion for itself. And, that's what it looked like for us. Guys didn't know where to get lined up. Guys weren't sure about where to be after the ball was snapped, and it was just a mess. That's the short
Brendan,
version.
Why do you think it is that Kelly was so hard on Kizer? And we say that not just to defend him because he's from Toledo and he's a Central Catholic kid, but I'm just looking at the points. You know, 47 against Texas, 39 in the win over Nevada, 28 in the defeat to MSU, and then 35, beg your pardon, against Duke. So they're averaging 36 points a game. The problem doesn't seem to be offense. But Brian Kelly made a point of saying that DeShone Kizer is not playing up to the standard that that position necessitates, that he's not getting it done, and that he would be included in this, hey, everybody's job is up for grabs thing. In fact,
right.
Hold on one second. Let me see if I can make that happen here. I just want to let everybody hear this again, the post-game commentary from Brian Kelly about this, if I can make this work in just a second.
When you're 1-3 at Notre Dame, everybody's job's in jeopardy. So it doesn't mean that you can't be who you are. It just means that there needs to be a sense of urgency and that you need to be focused, you need to be on top of it, and you need to go play the game the way it's meant to be played. Are we doing everything in our power to be the best we can be? And so that's the intent. That's how it's been articulated to our team. Each of our players understand that. Each of our coaches know it. It's not a threat. It is a reality of the sense of urgency that everybody has to embrace on a day-to-day basis.
So, correction, that wasn't the post-game. Hold on one second. That wasn't the post-game by Brian Kelly. That was the press conference this week, Brian Kelly explaining the post-game remarks. And in that press conference, he did say Kizer would start against Syracuse, but he is not, quote, meeting the standard of play, end quote, that is needed to play Notre Dame quarterback.
Yeah, I think there are a few things there. One, you know, he mentioned that if Kizer were a first-time starter, it would be a different standard, but he's played so well that he's effectively raised the bar himself, so I think that's part of it. I think Kelly knows with Kizer's makeup that he can be a little bit harder on him. You know, Kizer is one of those guys who nobody's harder on him than he is on himself, you know. I think there also have been, you know, Kelly said something in passing after Michigan State about Kizer tightening up his focus, that a couple times during the game he maybe wasn't as focused as he could have been. So I think maybe he sees some stuff he's trying to head off, and he knows from Kizer's makeup that he's more likely to react well to being held to that higher standard.
Yeah, and I certainly understand it, that if he raised the bar on himself because he played so well, you expect to see that again and again. But and maybe this just goes with the nature of the position, to single one guy out in such a way. And maybe it's just because it's not just the position, but it's the Notre Dame quarterback, not just a quarterback. You know, at the NFL level, that certainly is expected because it just goes with the territory. But the college level, I don't know.
Right.
Again, maybe I'm being very defensive of DeShone Kizer, but I do not see him as being the problem with the 1-3 fighting.
No, I don't think he's the problem. I think another part of it, too, is that, you know, and this gets a little more nebulous, but I think there's maybe a little bit of a leadership on this team. You know, we lost a lot of older guys last year that were very important voices for the team. And I think maybe, you know, we're seeing from the on-field product that, you know, the guys stepping into that role this year are not as vocal or maybe not as effective as leaders. And that's not saying they're bad guys. It's just, you know, they're not as cut out for it or as built for it as last year's guys were. So I think part of it, too, might be Kelly giving Kizer an extra little push to be in that leadership role, to see if he can really grab the reins and, you know, lead everyone to a better situation.
Is Brian Kelly in any kind of jeopardy?
Well, if you listen to a lot of our fans, he should be. I don't think so. I think it would take some kind of monumental collapse this year. I think he and Jack Swarbrick, the athletic director.
What's monumental? You know, you said a minute ago, or at the beginning of the interview, you said, you know, that maybe 500 would be something people are looking at to salvage the season.
Right.
500 would be a monumental collapse for a team that was supposed to go to the playoffs.
I think, you know, if we're talking 3-9, 4-8, I think there's a pretty good chance he'd be gone. 5-7, it's a grayer area. I think anything 500 and above, you know, he's going to get that chance to clean up the issues and come back stronger next year. I think obviously hiring Van Gorder was his decision. Sticking with Van Gorder into this season was his decision, because there were already a lot of whispers last year that he should have been fired. So, you know, he bears a lot of responsibility for that. But, you know, I think he's going to get a chance to recover from the mess this year, you know, now that Van Gorder's dismissed. And that will come into play when evaluating him somewhat. I also think there's a couple things. One, he and Swarbrick have the athletic director. They have a great relationship. And also, you know, it's not that long ago that we didn't really fire Lou Holtz, but we kind of pushed him out.
Right.
And obviously he's a very good coach, right? And we said, we don't need this. We can do better. And then we wandered through the wilderness for over a decade, you know. So I think there's still an institutional memory of that, and that nobody's in a rush to get rid of a good coach hoping to find a better one.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And Brian Kelly, I happen to be of the opinion that he is a very good coach. I don't know what's going on. I don't know if it's all on Van Gorder. I don't know what the issues are. But I happen to believe he's a very good coach. I'm not saying they should push him out, but this is, you know, this is college football. This is a multi-billion dollar industry in 2016 where wins equal dollars. And when you're Notre Dame and the alum, and you've got all the, you know, the alumni to please for the great golden history of Notre Dame football, and it isn't happening like this. You know, it's sometimes good coaches, even if they're the right coach, you know, end up getting pushed out just to placate certain types of people in the fan base.
Yeah, definitely. Certainly it happens. Certainly, you know, the patience level in college football is increasingly short, right? And this is Kelly's seventh season, you know, so there's some merit to the argument that this kind of season should be behind him. I mean, the reality is that
that's true.
Even great coaches have bad years, but at the same time, this doesn't just look like a bad year. This looks like people are on the field that have absolutely no idea what they're doing, which is a little bit concerning, you know?
Yeah, as I look, Brennan, and thanks so much for the time. As I look at the schedule to come for the Irish, there's only two ranked teams on the schedule: Stanford and Miami, right now, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Syracuse, NC State, Navy, Army, Virginia Tech, and USC. It's not exactly a murderer's row that they're going to be running into here. How do you think they respond? Do they, you know, even though they have the 1-3 record now, and they are not a factor in the playoffs, there is no conference. I mean, that schedule should give them an opportunity to put together a pretty solid season. You know, if they lose one more, maybe that should be it. And if you find yourself at a, you know, an 8-4 kind of a season, I guess that's, you know, that might be the best that can be expected.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, 8-4 would be what, 7-1 the rest of the way. So I think that would be a pretty, put that in the win column for the year at that point. Right.
Yeah. Even though it's not a very tough schedule, I mean, you know, it's very achievable because of that schedule.
Right. The scary thing for us, again, is the defense, right? That anybody with a pulse, basically, we're going to be nervous about until we see the defense perform better. I mean, Duke's offense this year, in the first three games, they were not good. You know, they were a bottom quarter, offense in FBS football, you know, and they came in and just moved the ball all over us. So when you talk about a team like Stanford or even USC, they have their own problems, but they have plenty of athletic ability, plenty of talent on offense, right? You know, we worry about that until we see that this defense can hold down the fort. And, you know, we don't need them to be great. We don't need Alabama's defense out on the field. We need an average defense that can let the offense, you know, win the game for us essentially at this point.
That's a great point. And by the way, since you brought up Alabama, and I'll throw this at you, who's the best team in the country right now? And I say that, of course, so you know, with Ohio State coming off of a bye, maybe not being fresh in the mind, but go back to what you saw in Norman two Saturdays ago.
Yeah, that was very impressive. That was very impressive. You know, I think you have to – they're a newcomer, you know, or kind of crashing the party, I guess, this year. But I think you have to consider Louisville, too, at this point. You know, with what they did to Florida State, you know, you kind of believe it when you see it when they come up against a tougher opponent than that. But they're entering the conversation. I think Ohio State dismantled was very impressive. I think for now, you know, I'm going to stick with Alabama until, you know, they get into the meat of the schedule. I'll say what they, you know, they look shaky against Ole Miss again. I don't know what Saban's hang-up is with Ole Miss, but
isn't it funny? I mean, there's a team that just gets your number, and it's weird. And, he escaped this time.
Yeah.
But boy, I'll tell you what, that is a very strange occurrence, isn't it?
Yeah. But you know, we'll find out about them soon enough as they're getting into the meat of the SEC schedule, right? But I'll kind of go with them by default for now. But
who wins?
Definitely.
Who wins real quick? Death Valley. Deshaun Watson against Lamar Jackson in Death Valley. Louisville is just the the beast that has burst onto the scene. Lamar Jackson with 25 total touchdowns accounted for in four football games. Something you can't do on video games, for crying out loud.
Who wins on Saturday, right, Brendan? Right. You know, if you asked me before the Florida State game, I would have said Clemson easily. Before the Louisville Florida State. But, you know, after that, I'm becoming a little bit of a believer. I think maybe Clemson hasn't quite reloaded as much as you might have expected. So I'll take Louisville in a squeaker.
I think I will too. And you know what I think it is? I think it's those chrome helmets. They've got that chrome red helmet going on, kind of like Notre Dame's chrome gold.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
I think it's the sharpest helmet in football now. I think it's amazing.
Yeah, it's a nice look.
Yeah, it really is. And I don't know, obviously it doesn't affect anything, but they look really shiny going into the end zone so many times. Hey, Brendan.
Oregon gives them two thumbs up.
There you go.
Yeah.
Brendan Riley, 18stripes.com. Follow him there, read his work, and those of his colleagues at the Notre Dame fan site, 18stripes.com. Brendan, thanks for the time. We appreciate the breakdown of the Irish. Better luck the rest of the way.
All right, thanks, guys.
You got it. There you go. Hey, speaking of Catholic football, by the way, since we go from Notre Dame, let's go down to the high school level in St. Francis. On Friday, St. Francis is home to Lima Senior at the Glass Bowl. And if you would like to go take in that high school football game, I have got a four-pack of tickets for you. Not a pair, a four-pack of tickets, so you and the whole family can go. Just be the 10th caller at 866-240-1065, 866-240-1065. You don't have to be rooting for St. Francis, by the way, even if you're in Lima. If you want that four-pack of tickets, we will hook you up, St. Francis and Lima, on Friday at the Glass Bowl. All right, really good stuff there. We're going to shift gears and get into some NBA discussion for the first time this NBA offseason, now starting the preseason, if you will. They had media day on Monday. Practices are underway or are going to be beginning shortly. So we're going to talk to Rick Nolan about the NBA coming up as well, right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Tim Tebow striding to the plate confidently. First at bat of his debut. First pitch of his debut. Tebow driving one to left center and
whoa!
How about that, Paul Feinbaum?
I am cheering for my good friend and partner. I mean, listen, Tim is committed. That's typical of Tim Tebow. Why should anyone be surprised that he hits a home run in the first at bat?
Miguel drives one deep to the right center field gap. On the run, Almonte's by him all the way to the scoreboard in right center. Kinzer and Maven in. Cabrera to second. Two-run double. Three batters in. 2-0 Tigers. Fly ball, center field, deep. Going back, Naquin still going. Looking up. It's gone! A home run! Miguel Cabrera straightaway center. Three-run shot. Fly ball, left field, deep down the left field line. Goodbye, Justin Upton with a towering blast. Indians manager Terry Francona resting almost all of his regulars in this game. Only Santana and Naquin were among the regulars in the lineup. Seven reserves. And Justin Verlander took full advantage. He dominated through 7 2/3 innings. One walk, 12 strikeouts for Justin as he just absolutely cruised through his 7 2/3 innings. Lowered his ERA to 3.10, picked up win number 16.
This is what you always want, and this is what they want. Rookie or not, you want to pitch in these big situations and big games. I think we've got a good mix right now of guys that have been through the grind and understand what the ebbs and flows are like. And granted, this has been a little bit different than a normal season, but you still can understand that we have a good team. Just because we've lost a few in a row, we can turn it around just as quickly, and we've done that many times.
Really? Everyone kind of contributed. Every faction of the team contributed. Justin was outstanding. You know, Tito was probably doing some stuff with his pitching staff. He certainly has the luxury of being able to line up the guys he wants and needs going into the postseason. It helps a lot. You know, when you have one of the best pitchers in the game on the mound and you spot him a 5-run lead early, you certainly feel good about where you are. You're never comfortable, but you feel good about where you are.
I don't know about best case, but I mean, it's a heck of a lot better than it could have been. I think we were hopeful that he'd be okay, but, you know, when a guy's out there competing, you don't know how much they're really hurt, but this will give them a chance to hopefully have a bullpen session or two, hopefully maybe to even help them. But I think it's certainly not bad news.
seeing the smiles on my teammates' faces and hearing the roar of our fans. That's the main thing. And, you know, being able to see my teammates get their ring, to see, you know, how much when you put in a lot of hard work, this is the benefit of it.
Well, with Mo Williams retiring, you know, with us losing Dele, you know, I think it's important to, you know, find who's going to play that backup point guard, you know, and, you know, we might have to do it by committee. You know, Kay's coming along, Kay Felder. We can play Shumpert some backup point with LeBron on the floor with him, you know, Jordan McRae. So we're going to have to do it by committee until we figure out, you know, what's the best, you know, thing for this team.
J.R. Smith is not here today. As we've stated and coaches previously stated, we think very highly of J.R. We love him as a member of our team, and for that reason, we've made an incredibly competitive and aggressive offer to re-sign him. We hope that gets done in very short order.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Apparently not in, what were those words again? Competitive, incredibly competitive, and what, aggressive, I think was the word?
Yes.
Apparently not competitive or aggressive enough for J.R. Smith, at least at this point, as the Cleveland Cavaliers head into training camp and the start of their practice season. That was from Media Day on Monday. Welcome as we continue right here on ESPN 106.5, The Ticket, into hour number two. Hey, before we talk more basketball with our good friend Rick Nolan coming up here in just a second, we do need to identify the KeyBank High School Athletes of the Week. We like to shine a spotlight on all the young kids doing outstanding work in their chosen fields of play. For the girls, Bowling Green Volleyball's Mackenzie and Maddie Dunn. The cousins were the BG leaders in their straight set win over Northview Tuesday. Mackenzie had a game-high 34 assists to go with 13 digs and 11 kills. Maddie had 12 kills and 12 digs. The win for the Bobcats, vengeance for their only loss of the season to the same Northview squad, as BG is now 14-1 overall, leading the NLL at 8-1. For the boys, St. John's running back Tyler Turner carried it 22 times for 222 and three touchdowns in the 44-14 win over St. Francis on Friday. St. John's now 4-1 on the year, 1-1 in the track, currently number 9 in Division 2 Region 6 playoff computer rankings, putting them just on the outside looking in as they get ready for to get into the second half of the season. So they are your KeyBank High School Athletes of the Week for this Wednesday afternoon. All right, let's bring Rick Nolan in. Rick, of course, our good friend from out there in Cleveland, Lorain County area, Medina County area, writing for the Elyria Chronicle Telegram and the Medina Gazette, I should say. And he has just been covering these Cleveland Cavaliers for a long time. Finally got to cover a world championship team just this past June. Rick, good to have you back again. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. It's good to be back, although it seems like last season just kind of wrapped up a couple days ago almost. So I could use another 2-3 week of off season, but full steam ahead from here on out, I guess.
You know, it's weird. We were literally just, Jim and I were just talking about this on yesterday's show. It does seem like a blink of an eye. It feels like, you know, we were just watching Game 7, and I suppose it's a matter of perspective because, you know, right here in Toledo, we have a ton of Pistons fans, you know, listening as well. Their season ended way back in April, at the end of April. So, you know, for them, it's like, man, I want to get the next season started. But for the Cavaliers, who played deep into June, obviously, in winning the championship, it really hasn't been that long of a downtime, has it?
Not at all. I mean, not only did they play until the third week of June, but, you know, they had a really busy offseason. LeBron didn't sign until near the end of August, and, you know, they did the Dunleavy thing. So there really wasn't an off season for, well, not to whine, but from a media standpoint, until until almost the start of September. And I have to say the last 3 weeks were pretty nice because there wasn't a whole lot going on with them either way. So,
but did you think of stuff to write about, though, during that downtime?
You know, I stayed as far away from writing anything about them as I could, knowing that starting this past Monday, probably until the middle or late of June again, that it's going to be basically, 9 months straight of Cavs coverage. So I felt no guilt stepping away from them for 3 weeks.
Well, from your mouth to the basketball gods' ears, that they get back to another finals and play into that third week of June again. Let's talk about some of these things that have happened in the offseason. Let's talk about the one thing that did not happen first, and that, of course, is JR. We just heard a clip there from Griffin talking about the aggressive offer that was made, the aggressive and what was the other one, Jim?
Competitive.
Competitive offer.
Incredibly competitive, yes.
Yeah.
Incredibly competitive.
And what is it that JR is looking for that the Cavaliers won't give? And what's it the Cavaliers don't want to give to JR? Because, you know, I mean, it's not like there's really a chance that he's going to go sign with somebody else for any big dollars right now based on where things are. So what exactly is he holding out for?
Well, that's the complete unique thing about this, Bob. We could probably spend the whole segment just talking about it. But I don't know that I've ever seen a contract negotiation like this before, for a number of reasons. JR wants to play for the Cavs. The Cavs want JR to play for them. They're a perfect fit for one another. But there's nobody else bidding for JR, near as I can tell. But yet he still has some negotiating power in that, LeBron loves him. Tristan Thompson mentioned they don't win a championship without him on Monday. The Cavs are basically bidding against themselves, and I think they want to be fair and are willing to be fair. But then, you also have the whole blow-up of the salary structure this summer. So in a nutshell, I think JR is going to ultimately get a contract between around 12 million, maybe as high as 13, 14 million per season. I think.
But he's not going to get the 4 years, is he, Rick? He wants a longer term deal, doesn't he?
Yeah, here's the way I view it, in my own mind. Ideally, the Cavs would love to sign him for 2 years. Ideally, I think JR and Rich Paul would like to get 4 years. I think the Cavs are really hesitant to do that with a guy who's going into his 13th year, and have some baggage with him. He's been good here, but 2 years is, I think, what the Cavs would want, and 4 years is what JR wants. I think ultimately they're going to come to an agreement on something in the middle. But I think the sticking point in the middle is the Cavs would like that third year to be a team option, and I'm sure JR would like that to be a player option. So I think that's in my mind, from where I sit, that can be the only real sticking point here. I think he's going to get something in the 3 year, $40 million range when all's said and done. That's what everybody else that played his position, has kind of gotten this off season, although a lot of them got 4 years in the $52 million range. So I think that the one thing to be worked out is that third year going to be a team option or a player option?
Rick Nolan is our guest, Cleveland Cavaliers beat writer, covering the club, the world champion Cleveland Cavaliers. Got to get used to saying that. What has been the best development of the offseason for the Cavaliers as they try to prepare to defend their championship?
Well, I mean, I think you always have to start with LeBron. And the fact that he signed for 2 years with the third year player option instead of the 1 year with a player option than he did two times previous. So I think that was actually a really pleasant surprise to the Cavs. It certainly surprised me some. I was fairly certain that he would do the same thing he had done previously and sign the 2 year deal, but really would only be a 1 year deal. So now they know they have him the next two seasons for sure, and don't even have to worry about the opt out and the renegotiating part. I think the other real solid thing that they did is bring Mike Dunleavy in. I think he's a real good fit for this team, and he can play two positions. Intelligent player, like JR, a guy that doesn't need the ball a lot but can score volume points with having it in his hands limited times. I think, Chris Anderson will help him a little bit. And they needed size with Mozgov leaving. So, all in all, I think it was a pretty successful offseason for them. Other than I have concerns. I apparently have a lot more concerns than David Griffin, judging by what he said Monday at media day, but I think the backup point guard spot is a legitimate concern, and though you said they're comfortable where they sit, I won't be surprised at all if at some point in the preseason or on into the regular season we get a veteran with some experience at that spot coming in here. I think to rely on Kay Felder right now as your primary backup might be a little bit of wishful thinking.
Were you surprised, Rick, that Mo kind of retired, then unretired, and then said, nah, I'm going to retire?
Yeah, I keep waiting for him to come back again. maybe by Monday he'll be in camp again. No, not really at all. I think Mo's left knee is pretty much shot, in my opinion. And I think even if he'd have stuck to his original plan to try to play another year, I'm not convinced that the Cavs wouldn't have perhaps cut him and ate the salary anyway. It does, you know, good to have a guy, no matter how good he would be if he was healthy, if he's never going to be healthy. And
right. That
was pretty much the case for Mo from, about the third of the way through last season, all the way into the playoffs. And any type of extended activity just led to another injury and another down period. And I didn't have any confidence that was going to change this season at all.
Let's go back to J.R. Smith for a moment. We're talking to Rick Noland, who covers the Cleveland Cavaliers, as we get ready for our first bit of NBA coverage here, as the start of the practice schedule is at least here. Jim Kushlin alongside us as well. Jim, go ahead, bud.
Yeah, and Rick, I'm kind of glad that you explained it that way a few moments ago, because that's something that I had read mid-late last week, that the real point of discussion here in these JR and Cavs negotiations right now is not money as much as it is length of contract. I really kind of like the scenario you lay out, and I personally would have no problem if it's the third year, even if the third year is a club option or just a part of the contract, even if it's not a team option, because, you know, despite his past issues, that's why the phone hasn't seemed to be ringing again this past offseason. I think a lot of GMs out there are thinking, well, yeah, but if we take him away from LeBron, is he just going to turn into Knicks off the court issues kind of J.R. Smith? So I'm glad you pointed those things out, because I had read that last week and thought, well, that's interesting, because it's not necessarily about money. It's more of about a contract length. Now, all that being said, and you kind of laid it out, at this point, I'm starting to think it might turn into, in terms of when it gets done, to what we saw last year with Tristan Thompson. It may not get done for a couple more weeks at this point. I certainly expect him by opening day, just like Tristan was, to be signed and with the Cavs.
It may not. Rich Paul's certainly not afraid to drag things out. And, you know, let's also remember a couple other things. Tristan missed all of training camp. Didn't hurt him or them in the slightest bit in the grand scheme of things. I think the other thing that's real important to remember is when you look back to JR's free agency period last season, when that was going on, the view of virtually everyone was that Iman Shumpert was going to be the starting shooting guard on this team, and JR was going to be the backup. And JR ended up playing for $500,000 less last year than he would have made had he simply exercised his player option. So in that regard, free agency was a big, colossal fail for him. But the positive side for JR is that we all know that Chump showed up with a broken wrist, and JR ended up being the starter all year and through the playoffs, and played extremely, extremely well, and is an extremely valuable player to the Cavs. I don't think there's another team in the league that he would be close to as valuable to, and I think there's a little bit of feeling in JR's camp that the Cavs owe it to him to do right by him, and I don't think the Cavs have a big argument with that. Again, I think it all comes back to lengths, and I can't fault David Griffin if Rich Paul's asking for 4 years and won't come off that in the slightest bit. I think that's unrealistic. But again, the Cavs need JR. And, you know, they need him for not only what he brings on the court, but, for the camaraderie and the feel good nature that they want to continue. I think if the Cavs don't get this done, they're going to have a lot of other unhappy players in their locker room that it didn't get done. And I think David Griffin knows that. I think Rich Paul certainly knows that, and he's trying to use it to his biggest advantage.
Let's talk, and one unhappy guy, of course, would be the superstar, and that's not something you want to have happen. Let's talk about the other two superstars, the big three. Different feeling altogether coming into this season. Obviously, you know, Kyrie hits the shot, which it's kind of being called now, along with the block and the stop. I saw you reference that on Twitter, Rick. And you know, all of this stuff about can he hold up for an entire season? Is he too brittle? Is he too frail? Blah, blah, blah. Can he fit with LeBron, or does he have to be too ball dominant to really work with another superstar and win a championship? Obviously, they answered all of those questions, as did Kevin Love. Finding a way to fit, finding a way to use his multitude of skills, not in the way that he used to use them for Minnesota, but in a championship mixture now. With the pressure off and all of them sporting rings now, do you feel like it's going to be a lot easier for them to get into that comfort zone and that groove early on rather than another season of finding their way and then kind of finally finding the chemistry at the
end? Yeah, I think it definitely will. And we all know that athletes talk a tremendous game about their confidence and their inner security, mental toughness. And I think with Kyrie and Kevin, you know, especially Kyrie, I don't know that that's ever necessarily been the case until now with him. I think, you know, as polished as a speaker as he is publicly, there was like an inner anger with him, or even some insecurity that I have to prove this to people. I have to show them. I have to let them know that my way is the right way. And at that same time, there was an uncertainty in his own mind if that all that was true. And I think what that shot did in that split second was, it validated to Kyrie that, I am an upper echelon player. I'm not a prototype type point guard, but I can be a championship player. I have a championship ring, or I will have one on October 25th to prove that now. And I think that's huge for him. And I think we will see a much more, relaxed and truly confident player, throughout this regular season than we ever had before.
Yeah, and that is certainly something that you know has got to make Cavs fans very, very excited, because there is always those questions. There have always been, and you're right, I feel like he kind of always felt like he had to prove that, and that, of course, created discomfort for him and discomfort for the fans. And now that, of course, all of that pressure is gone, they've proven they can do it. Hopefully that leads to a comfort zone that really gets them grooving early. Now, let's talk about the challenge with the rest of the conference. Obviously, some changes. You know, the Bulls certainly got weaker, very, very different team, new coach, Derrick Rose gone. The Knicks, possibly, depending on how they can figure out how to share the ball.
Yeah,
with Derrick Rose and Carmelo and Porzingis and, you know, Joakim Noah, now the defensive stopper, moves over there. Is there a threat in the East that the Cavaliers need to be worried about?
The one word answer is no. Boston certainly got a little better. I gotta say, and I hope the team isn't the same way, but Bob, I'm having a hard time getting excited about the regular season. Media Day, we were 5 hours into it, and one of the other reporters that covers them on a regular basis just blurted out what I think a lot of us were thinking. Can we just skip the entire 82 regular season and just go to the playoffs? It sounds horrible to say before you even played a preseason game, but this regular season doesn't mean a whole lot of anything, to the Cavs, other than, you know, the cliche process, improve, get better every day. I don't think it makes a whole lot of difference whether they win 52 games or 70 games. They've proven that they're the class of this conference, and I don't think there's still anybody close enough to them to change that. I if they're healthy, I find it extremely hard to see any team in the East beating them four times in seven games. Now, they have to find a way to challenge themselves for 82 games and to set little mini goals. And you know, if they have to resort to some takeoff of a 16-piece puzzle gimmick or hide money in a locker room ceiling or whatever, they'll find a way to do that, I think. But I hope for their case that they're a little more motivated and enthusiastic than I find myself at the moment.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. How do you find a way to get motivated against teams that you are clearly superior to for a very, very long regular season? But that is, you know, that's Ty Lue's job. It's his job to make sure that they do. It's in part, it's LeBron James' job, too, to make sure that you are playing, you know, I don't want to say at your peak all season long, but that you are staying at the level you need to be at in order to be hitting your stride when the playoffs do come around. But I do see your point. It can get mundane if you are rolling a bunch of inferior teams in your conference. So let's skip over to the other conference where there aren't a whole lot of inferior teams. And there might be a superior team, and that, of course, is the team they just vanquished in the finals in the rematch. You know, you add an MVP to an MVP to another MVP candidate, and I'm talking about Green, and do another one, really, in Klay Thompson. It's really kind of crazy what Golden State was able to pull off there with bringing Kevin Durant there. How much better did they get? And is it a foregone conclusion in the West, in the same way that you just described it to be in the East, that it is going to be a Golden State-Cleveland rematch in the finals? A three-match? Ooh, did I just create a new word? Has anybody ever said three-match before? Pat Riley got three-peat and made a mint off of that. I mean, if they play in the finals again three times in a row, it's a three-match.
Three-meat. Three-meat. It even sounds better than...
Yeah, it does. It does. I got to call somebody. Jim, give me a lawyer on the phone. I got to copyright this right now.
I will trot that out and they give you credit for it at some point in the playoffs if it doesn't come up before then. But
I would appreciate that. I would appreciate that. I like it. I really do. So anyway, so what do you think? I mean, are they now head and shoulders above the rest of the other very, very good teams that have, you know, that have challenged them in the West the last few years?
Well, I mean, I think they would be a lock if they were in the East instead of the Cavs. I still think there's teams in the West capable of challenging them and beating them in a seven-game series. I would put Oklahoma City and the Clippers at the top of that list.
Oklahoma City without KD, you think would still be a challenge here and a threat to the new KD and Golden State?
Well, it's going to take another move by them at some point, I think. But I think the Clippers are certainly have enough talent to push them. I think, you know, San Antonio, you can never discount them. I would think Golden State is clearly the favorite. I don't think they're the lock the Cavs are, though, in their respective conference, if that makes any sense. And I think that the Kevin Durant thing is going to work out really well for them. I don't think, you know, the one basketball theory is going to be as big an issue as some people think. But hey, look, you know, we were just talking about the Cavs being motivated. Golden State won a title, you know, in 2015 and then won 72 games and then didn't win a title. So, no matter what they do in the regular season, they're in the same boat in the Cavs that, you know, whether their season's been a success or a failure is ultimately going to be determined by whether they win a championship. And they now have that tiny bit of uncertainty that the Cavs previously had and no longer do. Are we championship material? If we didn't get it done when we won 72 games, you know, can we be more confident now than we were then? I don't think they can. They can talk the talk, but they're going to have to get it done on the floor, and more than likely, they're going to have to get it done against Cavs.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think I think it's very interesting, and we'll let you run after this. The story that just kind of came out today, and I don't know if it was Westbrook. I think it was Westbrook who mentioned this at their media day. He and Kevin Durant have not spoken since Durant signed with the Warriors. Not a text, not a phone call, nothing. Calling into question the friendship or the partnership or whatever you want to call it that they ever had together when they were playing. They both tried to make it sound like, no, we love each other, this is a great thing, when clearly each of them wanted to be the man, and they really didn't really, you know, have that close of a relationship. They haven't even talked. So if there is to be an Oklahoma City challenge to the Warriors' supremacy in the West, it might be fueled by the rage or the anger or the dislike or whatever it is you want to call it, the Russell Westbrook, who is already at, what, I think, fourth in the MVP voting last year, that he has to try to chop his friend's knees out underneath him.
I don't know how much more that kid can do and how much harder he can play than he already does. One of my favorite players to watch, just, you know, he doesn't always do the right thing, but there is never, ever, ever a lack of effort from him on either end of the court. So, I don't know. Durant put himself in a kind of a weird position because, without the fanfare and without the playing 40 miles from his hometown, what he did to Oklahoma City, probably stinks a little more than what LeBron did to the Cavs in 2010.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who made that comparison when it happened. I can tell you this, he's always been one of my favorite players, and he went right down to the bottom of that list, or maybe the top of the list of the players I don't like and can't stand anymore because of the way that whole thing went down. It's one thing to leave and say, I want to go chase the championship. It's another thing to go and chase that championship with the team that just beat you. And
exactly.
And saying, I couldn't beat you, so I'm going to join you. LeBron didn't do that with the Heat. There is a little bit of a difference there. And so to me, there's no doubt that he is going to have to embrace the role of the villain. And I don't know if he likes that. I don't know if he likes that idea because he likes to
either.
Be liked. You know, he really likes to be liked and respected. And if that's something that maybe gets under his skin a little bit, being booed everywhere he goes as part of, you know, the way the Heat were, they became the villains, then maybe that's not a good thing for the Golden State Warriors. But, of course, time will only tell. Rick Nolan, great conversation. We appreciate it. So glad to get another season lifted. I do agree with you, the offseason was far too short, probably more so for you than for everybody else who watched that finals and feels like it was just yesterday. But I am glad it's back because that means we get to chat with one another once in a while. So I certainly look forward to that.
Sounds like a plan.
Thank you, Rick. Have a great day.
All righty, Bob.
Rick Noland, the Cavaliers beat writer from out in greater Cleveland area, talking about the defending champions. And he doesn't see a threat in the East. You notice Jim Cushlin, he did not even mention the Pistons.
Yeah.
And I don't think that was by disrespect. It's just a matter of, Miami might have been a threat last year if Bosch had played. We know Bosch is done now. Pat Riley, for all intents and purposes, said Chris Bosch's career with the Heat is over. They're never going to let him play again, given his physical state. So they're not a factor anymore. You mentioned the Bulls got weaker. The Knicks got stronger, but it's just a very weird dynamic there. I don't know if they can play together. Boston got a little better. He did not even mention the Pistons, the Cavaliers' first-round opponent in this past season's playoffs.
Well, the simple fact of the matter is, and you'll hear me bring this up as we go through the season and even in the preseason with some of our previews, we'll eventually have some Pistons guys, of course, on as well. To me, Bob, the top four in the East, in no particular order, are Cleveland, Boston, Toronto, and Detroit. The problem was the three non-Clevelands there, as Rick pointed out, I'm in complete agreement, just like a season ago when we were hitting the playoffs, I do not see any team in the East being able to take the Cavs 4 out of 7. It's just not going to happen. Those are the three other competitors for a possible Eastern Conference Finals matchup, though, and if you're non-Cleveland in the East, that probably is your ceiling. But that's why I'm going to find it interesting, the motivation thing that we're talking about.
Yeah.
You know, how do you keep these guys motivated for 82 games? I believe it was a week or two ago they started coming out with some of their Vegas's over-under for wins. I think it pegged the Cavs at 56, and I read a lot of people saying, well, you know, expect them to be under. No, actually, I'm going to put them right there just because that's kind of how it played out last season. I think you're going to rest the guys at the end. It's also why...
Not just at the end. not just at the end.
Throughout
the
season.
I can see Tyronn Lue doing a little bit of Popovich-type work here.
Yep.
You know, throughout the season, LeBron is going to be down on a road game. You know, Kyrie is going to be down. Kevin Love is going to be down. And it's going to be all about keeping their bodies fresh for the playoffs in the same
way
that Pop
has done. They won't sit all three at the same time until right before the playoffs in April.
Exactly. After everything is clinched and all that sort of thing. But they will put them down individually, again, in the same way that Pop did and has done for so many years. Tony Parker's getting this one off. TD, you know, Duncan, who of course is now retired, gets 2 days from now and so on and so forth. It angers a lot of fans who paid top dollar when the Spurs come to their town to see the greatest players in the sport. It angers a lot of people, but it always worked. And five championships in 20 years or so for Popovich proves that. And now that LeBron is getting up there in age, in his, you know, lower 30s, you know, and Kyrie isn't really getting
I wouldn't even mind, Bob, if he took one of those two-week hiatuses in mid-January like he did a couple years ago.
Yeah,
I honestly wouldn't be upset with him.
I don't know if I want to go that far. I don't know if I like that.
Fair
enough. I
don't
think he'll need that, though, too, you know, to be honest with you, Jim. I don't think he would need that. I think he would just need those spot, you know, rests, maybe extend, you know, a couple of days off if you've got them and then give him the game off so it's a 3-day break.
They've already been doing well with his minutes. His minutes the last 2 years have actually been some of his lowest minutes per game of his career. And that's what you need if you're going to keep, you know, wanting to extend LeBron's talents, further and further into the future. Same principle, by the way. The, Warriors, of Vegas over under had him at 66 wins. And I say, that's absolutely right on the money as well, because you know why? This is probably the safest bet in the NBA in 2016-17. The Warriors are going to rest people through the season. They're not chasing any win record. That is not going to happen. You're going to see Steph and Green and Durant and Klay Thompson do the same possible thing that you were just talking about with LeBron and these Cavs. You're going to see them rest at intermittent times. I absolutely guarantee that's going to happen. And even if it is only 66, that's still 66 and 16, nothing to sneeze at, and they're still capable of that. But watch, they're going to rest. They are not chasing any record this time.
From their vantage point, too, Jim, it'll be easier for them to rest because, for example, let's say they sit KD once in a while. They still have the same high-powered 73-win team they had last year.
Right.
KD, with the exception of Harrison Barnes.
And some of the bench, because you had to clear out some salary somewhere for KD.
The guys who led them to 73 wins were all still there.
Yeah, and Iguodala is still going to come off that bench, too, for example. Yeah,
if you need to rest Curry,
they'll be just fine.
If you need to rest Curry for once, last year if you rest Curry, you lose 30 points a game. This year you rest Curry, you have Kevin Durant is a 30-point game. In other words, you have so much more firepower now that resting some of these guys really won't hurt you as much. I agree. I think they're going to win a number of games in the 60s. I don't know if it'll be 66 or 4 or 7 or 9, but it won't be 70 again, but it'll still be a tremendous regular season.
They're going to do it this year the Popovich way, because at the same time, they probably won't say it publicly, but in private, they'll acknowledge, hindsight 2020, we totally should have done that. It wrecked us to a small degree in the playoffs with some of our bumps and bruises and then whatever Curry was dealing with. That's why I feel that's the safest bet in basketball in the NBA this year. The Warriors are going to treat it like the Spurs do, or even the Cavs will do. They're not chasing any record this time. Yep, they know better now.
No doubt about it. No doubt about it. By the way, there was one story I didn't mention with Rick Nolan that I want to get into, but I'm going to take a quick time out here before I do that. And I'm also going to tell you once again about the Buckeye Store and more, the College and Pro Superstore. Can't tell you enough about it. Buckeyes, you know how we said it's been like a blink of an eye since the basketball season ended, and here it is again. It's just the opposite for Buckeye fans when there's a bye week. You know what I mean? You can just tell that in Columbus, you're just like walking around nervously back and forth pacing. How come there's no game today? Having a bye week when you're a Buckeye fan is just painful. And now they get to take out all of the frustrations and the waiting on Rutgers on Saturday. The Buckeye Store and more, the College and Pro Superstore. Get the gear that you need to watch that game and all games if you want to wear it or decorate your house with it, for crying out loud. Maybe you want to decorate your wedding in scarlet and gray. You know what? There's a lot of Buckeye fans that actually do that. 10% store-wide savings on all the Buckeye and all of the other gear at the Buckeye Store and more. That means the fan zones for Michigan, Notre Dame, Michigan State, Toledo, BG, and the Tigers. Also, 10% off every single thing in the store. 50 to 75% off in the mornings on select items for doorbuster sales. That's right. Just get to Sylvania, 5700 Monroe Street. That's Starlight Plaza. Look for Big Brutus on the Roof. It's right there between Ralphie's and Dave's. You can't miss it. The Buckeye Store and more, your college and pro superstore in Sylvania. I'm going to tell you a story about the Cavaliers and money. money left behind in Oakland, California, in last year's finals. It was a tremendous story. Rick Nolan told it in print. I did not ask him about it in our radio interview, and I should have. So I'll try to paraphrase it and convey it to you, but I think you'll enjoy it as we continue right here on The Ticket.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
All right, rolling on and getting close to wrapping up the extravaganza on this Wednesday afternoon. Thanks so much for being a part of the show. Don't forget, you got drive time coming your way with Mr. Miller right at 5 o'clock. So stay here even when we are done. Jim Kirschlin, I understand you were doing a little fact-checking to see if indeed the three match that I was calling it, I think he called it a three-meet. I still think I like three-match better just because it sounds like
we... Either way, I'm going to look up some lawyers after the show.
Yeah, we got I got to copyright that. If they meet again, it would be a three-match, and I don't know that it's been done very often. And what did you find?
I found it is incredibly rare, and I'm only through three of the sports. I'm about to check the Stanley Cup Finals, but at least in terms of NBA Finals, World Series, and Super Bowls. So that's three of your sports right there. There's only been one time that I've discovered out of those three sports where, because back-to-backs happen a lot, although incidentally it's only happened once in the Super Bowl, those two, 92-93 with the Cowboys and the Bills. Right. That's only back-to-back Super Bowls that have been the same matchup. It's happened a bunch of times in the NBA and in Major League Baseball where you've had the same matchup 2 years in a row, the back-to-back. But going three in a row out of those three sports, and again, I have to still look up the Stanley Cup Finals for hockey, it's only happened once. 1921, 22, and 23, the John McGraw New York Giants against Babe Ruth and the Yankees.
Wow.
The Giants won the first two, Yankees won the first three. Out of the three sports of NBA, MLB, and NFL,
right,
that's the only time a championship matchup has been the exact same thing 3 years in a row.
So if this
all
happens,
I'm missing is Stanley Cup Finals because I ran out of time and we're back in the segment now.
If this happens, you know,
we're in rarefied air in all of sports.
Historic, you know, type stuff here. You know what I'm thinking too? And I could be totally wrong. I'm just throwing this out there because back in the 80s, when Gretzky was, you know, just setting every record in the history of records with the Edmonton Oilers, and they were winning four cups,
mm-hmm,
their primary rival year after year was the Islanders, the Mike Bossy, Brian Trottier Islanders.
Right.
Billy Smith and the Pipes. I wonder if they went at it a couple times in a row. Maybe
nope, not in a row. 84 Oilers over Islanders, 85 Oilers over Flyers. It was Canadiens Flames in 86, Oilers Flyers 87. Oilers, Bruins in 88. So, nope, not
so
even two in a row.
Once in the finals. Okay. I just remember the Islanders were their own dominant team at the time.
80 through 83. Yes, the Islanders won four cups in a row, but they faced four different opponents.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, I don't know if you're going to find anything else then. So, this really could be something crazy.
Yeah, this would be very rarefied air. Absolutely.
I want to tell this story real quick just because it's really kind of cool. And Tyronn Lue, the head coach of the Cavaliers, did not tell anybody about this until media day on Monday, apparently. The Cavaliers had about 4,500 reasons to return to Oracle Arena for Game 7 of the finals in June. After they beat the Warriors on the road in Game 5, Coach Tyronn Lue collected about $100 from everyone in the locker room. Players, coaches, public relations staff members, equipment managers, trainers, doctors, and front office personnel. In all, he collected about $4,500, which he wrapped up and hid in the ceiling of the visiting coach's office at Oracle Arena. Unbeknownst to Lou, Dan Gilbert saw him doing it and recorded it. It was just showing, Tyronn Lue said at on Media Day, I was just showing the team that I had confidence in what we would do. We were going to go home and win Game 6, and then we were going to come back and get our trophy and get our money out of the ceiling in Game 7.
That is hilarious.
It was just some extra motivation. I think that is one of the funniest stories I have ever heard. You know, I mean, and it's obviously just symbolic because, well, for the players anyway. I kind of wonder how it was for the, you know, for the support staff there, the guys who make $45,000 a year. You know, if everybody in the locker room or, you know, gave $100 here, they're probably like, hey, man, what if we don't win Game 6? Are you going to give me my $100 back? The players, you know, obviously don't have to worry about that given their salaries, but it's just a symbolic thing. Guys, we have some unfinished business. We can't lose Game 6 on our floor. We got to get back there to get our money back. which is just all kind of awesome. I just love
that
story.
Is a great story. Research completed, by the way. It's only happened once in the Stanley Cup Finals in all these years, and I guess you could put an asterisk next to this one because this happened back in the original 6 days. All you hockey guys know that meant there were only six teams. 1954, 55, and 56, the Red Wings lost 2 out of 3 in a row to the Montreal Canadiens. So once in the NHL, once in baseball. It's never happened in football, never happened in basketball.
Wow. Amazing. So we could be in for a real treat come next June if we do get that three-match going. By the way, speaking of that three-match, going back to the story again, Tyronn Lue also said on Media Day, some people got it back, some people didn't. We charged $100 for a championship to some guys. We got it back to the right people. So he did wait until all of the on-court ceremonies were over before he went into the coach's office.
That's awesome.
And quietly retrieved the money from the drop ceiling in the coach's office.
Oh, I love it.
In Oracle Arena. How funny is that? The guys who needed it got their money back. The other guys, Ty just kind of called that the price of winning a championship. All right, that's it. Good stuff. Really enjoyed the conversation today. Great interview with Brendan Riley of Notre Dame, 18stripes.com. And thanks, of course, to Rick Noland talking NBA with us. Thanks to you, Jim Cushman. Thanks to you for listening. We'll see you tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock. Drive time is next. Stay there.